Welcome to Bet It Sports. I am Richard Holland.
And I am Duncan McKenzie.
Welcome back to Chicago, Duncan.
Thank you, Richard. It is good to be back. Although, I have to say, it was sad to leave our amazing show at Apex Art.
Yeah, New York was fun. Unfortunately, I only got to be there a couple days, but Duncan was there for the haul and did most of the work, and it looked fantastic. Kudos to everybody involved in Bad Sports and everybody who contributed materials for the archive. It looks great. And to Tom Sanford for organizing the lecture series and helping out install and every other thing for our amazing Jeffrey Deitch interview we ran last week and a number of events coming up. So it's good stuff. Now, this week, Duncan, we talked to Julia Fish.
Yeah, Julia Fish is a part of our Whitney Biennial series of artists. We wanted to interview everybody from Chicago that was in the Whitney Biennial, or everybody we think of as Chicago artists, although that is very Chicago-centric of me, and I will slap my own wrist in a minute. But we feel like our people get covered too rarely, and Julia is certainly in that category, and we were happy to have a chance to go to her studio and sit down.
Indeed, and it's great work. It's interesting talking about it. It's a great conversation. So here it is, Julia Fish.
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
It's actually a pretty sweet piece of gear, though, little guy.
Hey, Duncan, this might be the first time in the history of the show where you're louder than I am.
I feel like just being around you means that I'm actually going to have to sleep 12 to 14 hours a night all weekend to make sure that I do not get sick. I can't believe you've brought me here to infest me with your germ.
Well, you're sick already. I mean, you know, we know all about you and the monkeys and all that kind of weird shit going on, so. But I think you mean a different kind of sick. It's funny because I actually don't feel that bad anymore, but boy, oh boy, I can't talk.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some phlegm thing going on, and now you got a touch of the laryngitis, my friend. So because you can't talk, I'm going to talk about how we've adjusted the annual Richard Holland Day Festival to not be at Wizard World this year and to, in fact, be at the C2E2 comic convention, the one day a year where Richard Holland gets to, you know, take the lid off and be himself and surround himself with, let's face it, some of the most committed fanboys in the Midwest and a couple of fangirls. But really, who are we kidding?
Ladies, you know, if you're not feeling good about yourself or something and you want people to fawn all over you, go to a comic book convention. Honestly, it takes very little to draw a crowd.
Yeah, it's a committed dude fest at the moment, and we are here on the VIP press preview day. It is not packed. It is actually a very sort of I'm really excited about it. It's a lot more casual than Wizard World.
It opened up at 10, and I got here at like 10:30, and like Mike Mignola and like Ethan Van Sciver were just like sitting at a table, nobody talking to them. Like all the artists that are super duper famous were just here with their coffee. No one's here. It was crazy.
The joke that I want to make is, did you run over and instantly offer to blow them all? But I feel like I got to stop making blowjob jokes, especially on Bad at Sports, and especially when we have such a great guest like Julia Fish coming up right behind my stupidity and coarse talk.
See, the thing is, first of all, the blowjob jokes are the, oh my God, that's so horrible. I think I might have just gone blind. Wow. Oh my God. Yikes. That much human being should not be jammed into that little spandex. That is a big ass. Jean Grey got real fat, let me tell you. Where was I going with this? You know, if you're going to dress up in a costume, for God's sake, be fit. Oh, you know, the blowjob jokes are the only thing that keep this show funny, so we got to keep them. Like, we've lost all the rest of our charm. It's all we got left. You know, in terms of approaching artists of these things, like, I've gone and talked to a couple people who are just, you know, because it's really low-key. And, I don't draw comics. I don't have that level of technical skill. So other than me saying, hey, I like your work, you're awesome, I don't really have much to say. I can't afford to buy their drawings. Like, I don't want them to autograph 52 things for me. So it's just sort of like, hey, dude, you're excellent. I, you know, I shake people's hands, and I mean, and I walk away because, you know, there's 50 people in line who want to kiss their speckled asses. And I'm just not that hyped. I like it. I'm not that hardcore about it.
Yeah, and I feel like it's few and far between are the comic book artists who you do really want to get into their practice and think about why they've made the choices they have. And I feel like we've been fortunate to have such legends as Ivan Brunetti and Chris Ware and Scott McCloud on the show.
Chris Ware, who, well, I haven't seen him, is apparently making a very, very rare convention appearance here today. He's on a panel at like 5 o'clock. Sadly, I have to go back to work pretty much as soon as we're done recording this. But what are you going to do?
Oh, okay. In which case, I'm going to introduce Julia Fisher, or Richard's going to do it in just 1 second, and it's going to be amazing. She's amazing. Everything's amazing. And it's amazing that we are at a comic convention right now. Hey, you know what else that happened that was super amazing? So Faden knows that I'm a rabid Jeff Wall enthusiast, and I'm not sure how or why they know this, but they sent me an email about his monograph that's coming out very shortly, and asked if I wanted a copy, and they sent me a copy, and it is truly amazing. It's as comprehensive of Jeff's body of work as could possibly be, and it's incredible. And yeah, if you love Jeff like I love Jeff.
Is that one of those fighting books that you could, like, turn around and sell and put your kid through college?
No, it's not like the, like, Tash and Jasper John's, like, $800 book that then all of a sudden goes for a zillion dollars. But it is a, you know, a big $70 monograph of one of the most compelling photographers of the last half century. So, yeah, you know, kill if you have to. Get it.
All right, so with that note, I'm going to walk around with Duncan for a few minutes and get back to my job, unfortunately. So, nerds, be proud, be out. Don't be afraid to tell your coworkers that you've got a roller bag full of trade paperbacks. I honestly don't know how I'm going to lift this onto the bus. That's it.
He's not kidding. He actually brought a slightly larger than carry-on size roller bag, and it is filled to capacity with trade paperbacks. I am shocked. And frankly, a little bit horrified. How do you have time to read all this?
I'm going to retire someday, and I'm going to have plenty to read when I do.
Wherever there's a hang up, you'll find a Spider-Man.
We are here in the studio of Julia Fish, who is in the Whitney Biennial this year, which is very exciting. It shows extensively across the country, internationally, in Chicago. I've seen your work at, is it Rona Hoffman?
Rona Hoffman.
Rona Hoffman. You're going to have work up soon in the Modern Wing of the Art Institute.
Correct.
And I know that you mentioned that you had a show coming up at ISU.
In early April, all of April into early May.
Great.
Kind of a survey of some drawings, different from 96 to 2010. I'm excited about that,
so,
actually.
And so are we. I sort of think that we should start with the works in the Whitney.
Okay.
They sort of, because I like the idea that we can trace back certain lines of your work inside of the Threshold paintings.
Okay.
And maybe the thing to do is tell us a little bit about those paintings.
3 of 6 Thresholds. Followed the stairs and landings, the works that were shown at Rona Hoffman in spring 2008. So the three of them that are there are, I mean, ideally, I thought I would be making 6 paintings as a set, and Francesco Bonomi and Gary Carrion Muriari visited the studio, saw the drawings, were really interested, said, could we have the Thresholds? There was no way I could have 6 paintings in that time frame. So it was a bit of a press, but I figured out how I could think of 2 or 3. So I left a little latitude there. I'm, of course, thrilled to be involved, thrilled to have the work out in incredibly public sight. But I also am, I feel really fortunate that the work is in a gallery, one of the galleries at the Whitney, that is two other relatively quiet works. I mean, artists whose work is relatively quiet, Maureen Galas and Justin Brand. So I'm really lucky. I was very pleased.
Now, for our listeners who may not have seen your work, when you talk about thresholds, you're talking about you've done works based most, if not is all, I don't know actually if it's, is of your work is based around examining architectural elements of your living and workspace. Is that?
Since 91.
Yeah.
You know, we moved here in 91, and about 6 months later, the work just shifted. And at first it was, I don't think I understood that for, I don't know, a couple of years, that the house would keep sort of offering itself up. But I realized I didn't really answer your question about the thresholds. So
no, I just want to make sure that people, yeah. Maybe we could describe, I mean, it's going to be almost impossible to describe a painting on a podcast, but you could talk maybe about when you're looking at these architectural elements, what it is that you're looking for, how you use those things as you develop your work.
Well, when we were talking before the recorder went on, you, Richard, made this observation about even just this sort of template drawings that are here in the studio, that they have aspects of prior work that are evident. And I would, for me, immediately, it's that the thresholds have returned to actual size. So from 2001 to 2005, and even the stairs and landings, there were aspects of those that were actual size, but there were also scale drawings that were much smaller relative to the actual site. So from 91 to 2001, all of the work was, in a sense, actual size. They were fragmentary. They were excerpts of elements in the house, but scale, one-to-one, and sort of finding an element in the house that had a kind of visual complication, but also I think the one-to-one scale sort of offered a kind of authority and integrity to the image that, I mean, that's one of the entry fragments, and, you know, it declares itself. And so the living rooms, the drawings and the paintings from 2001 to 2007, 2008, I was really floating out into territories of plan and elevation that I certainly was really affected by architectural drawings, where the architect was imagining something very specific, but because of the constraints of a drawing, was imagining them at a different kind of scale. So what the thresholds are offering for me is a kind of return to scale, to one-to-one scale, but with the nature of two surfaces, or in a sense, kind of in a couple of cases, three kinds of information meeting each other, a progression of information up the surface of the canvas, here in the template drawings on this, you know, really schematic drawings, there's a collision of one thing against another. And that occurred in some of the earlier work from the house. But it's been pretty exciting to me to look down, which is a point of view that has characterized the work on many occasions, to fixate on a particular site, but also to have a kind of internal argument going on. That's a character of not all of the six, but most of them.
Back before that really nice architectural bookstore that used to be on Wabash closed up.
Prairie.
Yep. I had gone in there a number of times to look at, unfortunately, they were spectacularly expensive, or I would have bought them, books on architectural details. I was looking for a layout of a window for something once, and I can't even remember why.
So you go in there and they've got very technically exacting drawings of those sorts of things. And when, like your stair tread works, I mean, have very much that sort of similar feel, or the living room works, right? It looks, you know, it looks like a more minimalist version of a blueprint you're right. looking down upon. Did you study sort of method of drawing? Or?
No, not formally. Yeah. I've just looked at a lot of images, you know. And it part of the knockout for me is when I've been able to see drawings of a place that I've also walked through, you know. And to realize that, I mean, for me, the knockout is that the architect was able to envision those kinds of plans or elevations or details before the building even existed. You know, for me, it's complicated enough to record or translate or trace or, yeah, record is what I've done, is I have given information. I'm not inventing it. But maybe because of other work in my own history and a lot of other work that I think what I'm bringing to this sort of given information is a kind of, it's really permissive. I can look at the stair from as a profile or from above and understand that I have the latitude to use it to think about painting and to use it to think about formal things like color and shape, but that also hopefully have another kind of sort of visual read or visual impact, maybe emblematic, maybe psychological.
So you've probably spent many scores more time thinking about the architectural elements of this building than the person who designed it. Isn't that, I mean, like your level of like thought and examination and analysis of the space and how it's laid out and how things work. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, you speak admiringly of these architects, but you've taken it many steps beyond, you know, even the person who created it originally.
So. Right. And that's, you know, that there's a sort of long segue story about sort of finding out about the architect of the house. But to answer your observation, the architect didn't live here. So I think the work is proposing another subject, which is about occupancy and observation and constancy and repetition and what it means to stay, what it means to be in the presence of. Whereas the architect planned it and filed the plans. The short story about the architect is finding the building permit in the UIC library when I was trying to find out, you know, who is the architect, and realized that you can trace building permits by address, even if you don't have the architect's name.
No kidding.
So in a sort of on assignment to try to find out more about this house at some point, in response to someone else's request for information, sort of did a little research, went to the Historical Society, didn't find it there, but found out about these fire insurance plans, which are coded, you know, that's sort of our neighborhood over there. Anyway, it was an interesting sleuthing, and found out the name of the architect, Theodore Steuben. Found out that the house was built in 1922, not 1911, as we'd been told earlier.
So you're essentially always on the job. I mean, you never, I know artists are sort of always on the job, but like you more than maybe anybody I've ever met are sort of like...
Well, so far.
You're always around your subject all
so
the time.
Far. There, of course, have been times when someone has said, so you must know what's next, and sometimes I haven't known.
But you have a fair idea where it's coming from.
Yeah, and, you know, there have been times where I've where I've known, you know, 2 or 3 years ahead. In fact, the set of three of the thresholds there on the right on the wall, the photographs, are the three that informed these paintings that are at the Whitney. But all six were laid out way down low on the wall for a year and a half or so. I mean, I actually placed the image in that lower register of that wall so that I could kind of think about their location. I could keep working on other work that was happening at the time. They were out there ahead of me. The stretchers, are here for the others. And in fact, I'm adding a third, so there will be six, but at one point I only knew there were five.
It's funny, I want to come back a little bit because I want to make sure that everybody has a real sense of what these look like, because when we talk about you making work from your house, it could be all kinds of sort of representational modes. Like I think of Jeff Wall's photos of the studio, the corners
right,
of the studios
right.
or whatever. But your work is not that. It takes a very sort of like specific and generally non-perspectival kind of, or at least in the last few years, has taken a non-perspectival, a one-to-one ratio. Like you paint exactly the tile pattern as it exists in the floor and in this sort of deep and long looking, so that painting that confronts us is this exact kind of or exacting replication or representation of that space. And it's funny to think, because one of the things that I really like about the Threshold series is that there's a weird perspective implied. Like there, it's a moment
it's very
where
disorienting.
It breaks this kind of formula where even in the floor plans, it's very top down and they feel like slightly formalized architectural plans, and they're always very lovely and elegant, but these ones have this moment with that slightly fractures out, that you know that door frame is not represented as its footprint, but as a kind of perspectival. There is a representational issue of viewer. You have a viewpoint into that work, which is really unusual.
Well, it's more, that perspective is more dramatically placed. It's more, there's a kind of bracketing, actually kind of referred to those shapes on the left and right as these kind of color brackets. But that kind of perspective actually was in the work in a number of cases. And that, in fact, the entry fragment there on the left, hard to see, has a really slight perspective. We might have to stand right in front. But if you look at the very left side and follow the tile up, and the very right side and you file the tile, it's ever so slightly. On the left, it travels up in perspective, and on the right, it does as well. The pattern's so declarative that it's a kind of foil, I think, for that. And all of the entry fragments have that ever so slight perspective, so that they're not the frontal. They lean in a bit, because that's the view coming down the stairs. You know, I'm actually approaching that entry floor. You'll see that when you leave. You'll come down the stairs, and that entry floor will not raise up flat in front of you. It will behave closer to that, which maybe goes back as an example of how I was talking about occupancy, or the fact that I go in and out of that door all the time. So at the point that I started the work on the entry, we'd been here 6 or 7 years, and so it wasn't only the pattern, it was transition. And to me, that's maybe the really happy link in these threshold paintings, is that it's returning to a subject of sort of crossing over or moving through a space that I think I was really trying to get at in some earlier work, but it's just visualized in a very different way. What I didn't know until the work was really underway was that there would be could there be a way to describe movement across a threshold, which was really interesting to me as a kind of question. And so there's a lot of vertical mark, there's a lot of interruption, there's a lot of that the paint stroke, you can see here in the white and here, that the paint stroke is simultaneously building, but it's directional. You know, was there a way to record, to have sort of time or repetition of movement embedded in the surface? And I think I think they have that. And of course, the template drawings are just the kind of schematic of that.
This may be my own personal artistic hang-up, and I may be reading into this in a very simplistic way, but it's interesting that, I mean, the three series that I'm particularly familiar with, which are these threshold works, the Living Room series, is that right? The
title?
Okay, and the the Stair Works. What's the series called?
Stairs and Landings.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, really straightforward.
I mean, you've got all three of these are interesting elements metaphorically in structures, right? Like stairs literally are landing and elevation and changing from one place to another, and thresholds are obviously thresholds transitioning between two surfaces, two areas, And then living rooms as sort of the
all the meanings of that word. All the meanings of that word, too.
Right.
Those two words.
What's interesting, this isn't really a question, I guess, more than a rambling, but your work has a lot of, is informed very much by abstraction. Agnes Martin, it comes to mind right off the bat, but that's not as far. From what my perspective is, it's not what it is, because it's got all of this other metaphor and information in it that is more complicated than abstraction. Do you see these works as abstract, or do you see them more as metaphor, or?
Well, they're absolutely tied to their source, and I feel like it's not unusual that people might refer to the work as abstract, because it has that. I think that comes with editing an image and maybe building a paint surface in a certain way. But it's as much about leaving out, I think the work leaves out a lot of the familiar stuff that would ground it as representational. So I'm taking it out and adding it back in constantly. It's pretty important to me that the work has to address it's what generates it. So if the idea for the work, what's interesting to me about the threshold work was partly that word. Yes, it's these six thresholds in the second floor of the house that now we've been here. It's approaching 20 years, so that's starts to be kind of mind blowing. But the threshold, I'm really interested in that word has a lot of other kinds of associations, and on the threshold, through, across, crossing to the other side. I mean, I got to think about a lot of permutations of the meaning of that word. And I wanted the work to possibly convey that.
These threshold pieces seem much more, in contrast with the living room pieces where there's lots of choices about color. I mean, you're working with things that are more abstracted. You're not trying to necessarily convey, you're not painting a photograph of, an aerial view of your living room.
Right. But no, they were very diagrammatic.
Yes, very much so.
Absolutely.
That's the perfect word. These threshold pieces seem more journalistic. They seem more like, I mean, there's definitely the information is a lot more literal until you look at them up close, where you can see sort of the complex stuff that's going on with color and texture and direction of brush strokes. But at a distance, I mean, I'm looking at the one of the tiles. I mean, that, you know, because you've gone and you've got information on there, you could see where sort of the dirt is on the tiles, and it's very, it has a very sort of photographic feel to it in some ways. So I assume that that's obviously it was a deliberate choice. Why the move away from the diagrammatic into the more, to including all this information?
The entry on the left is from 97. So that's not part of this group.
Okay.
Oh, so the one on the left.
Yeah.
The tiles. So,
you know, it's interesting. I thought it was an odd, a bit of an odd piece with the group because it's not, it's a threshold area, but it's not the actual transition.
Right. No,
that's
of course. I realize that's a logical thing. It's in the territory.
Well, and also,
and
I'm,
so that's why
I'm being very simplistic. I mean, the tile that you're portraying in two of the pieces that we're looking at right now is the same. So I'm sort of being like, you know, very
it's the tile.
Basic. Right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right. It's the tile. No, the entries on the first floor, these are all on the second floor. And, I'm sorry, I was not clear about that. It does, I mean, that's actually really great that when I use that phrase, it's been interesting to kind of rethink or return to a subject at actual size. I was making that connection, that the entry, those earlier paintings from 97, 98, 99, were fragments of one site. These are specific sites that are made up of two or three kind of conflicting kinds of information. So on the one hand, that's a real formal description. One floor surface is meeting another floor surface. And I'm taking that literally, and I'm taking that meaningfully in, one could say, metaphorical terms, representational terms, but representing something else. It's not really the kitchen floor, you know.
Right.
It's a structure. It's a collision of a kind of one kind of structure. And, you know, I know this is from standing there looking at that site as I was thinking about whether these were the paintings to do next and think about next. But along with that comes this device of those fragments of door jamb are pressing that floor shape, and they are flat color. They go back to this unanswered question about the lumen and what's with the light fixture and why what is it with color. So each threshold has this kind of dominant color assignment, and that's partly descriptive but also really subjective. That this threshold to the southwest is entering a space that is highly colored in this range of green.
So I'm now going to say something historically and technically inaccurate. For those of you who know anything about Japanese architecture and are listening right now, feel free to scream expletives at your computer. In Japanese tea room architecture, generally, like the doors are frequently very, very low and small, so that you have to either bow or crawl in to the space so that you're aware of the transition.
Yes.
This seems very much about being aware of the transition. I mean, I don't know. I've built chunks of my house, and I couldn't tell you what the thresholds look like. I don't think I've ever, you know, unless I've had to glue it or nail it down, I don't know that I've given them any thought. So it's interesting that these are focusing on an area that you just sort of take for granted.
Well, one could say that about the entire house, right?
That's true.
That living in this house at the beginning was just where we were living, and it's just continued to, as I said, kind of offer itself. And so all the time I was involved with other work, I wasn't really thinking about the thresholds. It was other work that pointed me to these sites. I mean, I think that the attention in the in the living room floor plans. So it wasn't until I was doing these that I really paid attention to the fact that we're really talking about the same threshold space. This little notch, this in this sort of funny moment at the top of this painting, is literally the same site as that.
Oh, okay.
And it was drawing these, was tracing the floor plan from the entire floor drawing that we received when we purchased the house. It was realizing that there was that kind of squeeze and then a sort of breakout moment that animated these living rooms. And so, you know, back in 2001, when I first did those tracings off the floor plan, that wasn't really articulate to me. It was only when I started to think about, well, what is that shape, and got more specific about it, that I realized, well, the door has that proportion, and in order to understand why this was one of 10 paintings based on the second floor, that threshold space, that sort of transition space, was key to understanding the 1 to 10, one room to in a set of 10, but also that link was what really animated these floor plans. So that experience of drawing that out from drawings into the paintings sat in my head, you know, for another 5 years before it seemed that, oh, gee, I am really interested in this as a site. What's going on there?
It's funny to think for me about your work in our conversation here, because because you seem to have a lot more sort of zen-like understanding of your home, and this sort of like looking deeply, looking often, this being aware of these sort of moments and the sort of liminality as you cross through one space to another.
Perfect word.
And I have, for the last decade, I've understood your work through two rubrics. And one was a kind of like feminist rubric looking at the domestic. And the other was
I'm there too. Absolutely.
The other was this rubric of domesticating, sort of a minimalist approach to making work, that like the overall picture would be this sort of minimalist sort of formal thing, but it would be sort of labored and rendered, and all of that would be available in the actual surface of the picture itself. But to talk to you about these things, like those things haven't sort of come up nearly as much as this sort of this process of being and mm-hmm. living and, mm-hmm. and existing mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. space.
But I am existing. I think I use the word occupancy as much as I use the word living in, moving through. It's partly the nature of that second floor plan that is, with a couple of exceptions, you know, the doors are rarely closed. You know, so there's a sense of being in one place on that in the house, but with a kind of awareness of where I was just previously, not having to move away from. Not really leaving one room so specifically. I carry it around in my head, right? But that's tied to the domestic, and the rooms are domestic in that sort of classic early 20th century second floor, two flat space. It's really domestic scale. When you said you had thought there was this rubric of the domestic, the feminist, and then the abstract, and
the minimalist, this sort of like domestication of minimalism, and this question of like,
well, it's reinvesting. It's using minimalist vocabulary and realizing that it exists in these sort of different circumstances in my immediate surroundings. So it was really that art showed me how to look at something, and it was really a kind of putting on one pair of glasses from my world as an artist and looking at the domestic through a history of looking at painting and looking at 20th century painting, but boy, you know, looking at Giotto, looking at early Italian painting, looking at any kind of work in which there's an equal understanding of the flat surface and illusion, you know, that are both sort of talking to each other.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting about your work is, and I sort of brought it to Japanese architecture a minute ago, is that
then Duncan went to Zen.
Right. So. Well, so I'm going to take it the next step, which these very much, these are very literally an example of mindfulness, where you're being mindful of the space that you're in a way that people generally aren't. Is that an issue that you've thought about, or?
So I understand that mindful term. I like that term. I would fill that with all the air I could, that the mindful is the daily experience. The mindful is continuing to kind of try to look freshly at something that's the everyday. Being mindful of the events of one's life and how events of one's life can sort of offer one. The events of my life have offered me another way to see something that is already really familiar. It's just suddenly I'm able to, oh, right. This can mean that too. It might have meant something earlier in another version. There was one thought I wanted to go back to, and what that is that, and maybe it's related to being mindful, which is that, I mean, I think all artists do, but I think a lot about my own earlier work. I mean, I'm asked to do that from time to time, so that's one reason, but, I mean, what I was just sort of describing here, pointing to this picture of a living room painting, is I truly don't think this work would have happened if that work hadn't happened. And that's, you know, after a number of years of working, I think I started to understand that that was probably going to be the case. And, you know, that's a different kind of mindfulness, but there have been moments where the next project seemed like the wildest, strangest idea. I guess I've learned to trust that there's some reason, and earlier work starts to support that, even as radically different as the new work might look compared to that most immediately preceding it.
Well, speaking of the work preceding, what's the chronology with the stair paintings, the living room works, and then this? Was it living room, stair, this, or was it stair, living room, this?
It was living rooms, stairs and landings.
Okay.
And then thresholds.
That would have been my guess. It's like you're sort of zooming in.
And in fact, there were two of the paintings of the living rooms that incorporated stairs and landings as part of the, I mean, I sort of claimed those two spaces that were the two stairways as part of the second floor because they were inseparable, right? The stairways had to be part of the second floor just as much as they're part of the first floor. At sort of towards the end of doing this set of 10 living room paintings, I realized that there was other subject in those stairways. So sort of that was what opened up. And they were two of the most animated. There were a couple of others too, but they were complicated spaces. And I realized that just negotiating two different stairways on a daily basis, many times through a day, they're quite different from each other, that there was, again, there were these literal representations of difference, but that started to become extremely meaningful about a stair to a public and a stair to a private space, modest profile that signaled public and the sort of workmanlike back stairs that came out to the garden and to the studio. So, you know, that it started to just build up as these two things that are part of the day that point in opposite directions. They point away from each other. You know, it became on the one hand, it's all really flat fact information, but it offered yet another opportunity to sort of think subjectively. Objectively, subjectively at the same time. I mean, that's the other thing that the house has given me, is that it's all objective information. It's all been measured or traced or lifted. You know, there have been rubbings that then were measured that led to drawings. So it's all factually based, but it's given me a way to think. You know? The other thing that's been useful, and you had that experience, is that I'm not in the house when I'm making the work. And there have been works generated by the studio, but not very many. And I know that I owe a lot to the physical separation. That's just enough to give me that. I mean, I couldn't have painted this work in the house. That would have just been too cloying. That's over all these years, you know.
It wasn't a Poe story, but there's a story about like yellow wallpaper. About,
right.
You'd be working in the house as well. You know?
Yes, right.
Yeah. Come home one day and you'd be, you know, raving about the details of the house. Okay, so we've talked about your paintings, but this is work of yours that I haven't seen at all, which is, are those photographs on the wall, are they the basis for things, or are they in and of themselves completed works?
So, first off, right, they are photographs of places not here. They're not the house. And the top three are details of a meridian line in Rome, in Santa Maria degli Angeli, a vast kind of... It's actually Michelangelo did the interior of this church in what were the baths. Diocletian sort of are right there. So he was commissioned to do this church in this space. I went to Rome not knowing about the Da Vinci Code. Didn't know about a meridian line, right? And arrived there in December. Richard took me to this church and said, you know, you might be kind of interested in this thing over here. And I didn't know what I was looking at. But the reason he knew I would be interested was that there was this very beautiful inset marker in the floor with this, with numbers and text. And he knows I'm my interest in floors, so he took me. So I didn't quite understand what I was seeing. But what we're seeing in these photographs are the moment at high noon where the sun enters into the cathedral space through the smallest aperture and traverses that line. And through the course of a year, the sun tracks down the meridian line and then back. So those numbers are... days of the solar calendar. And the Catholic Church commissioned these meridian lines to be installed as a way of ascertaining exactly when Easter would be, because it was such a variable astrologic kind of condition, I guess. So the spaces the church could find were these vast cathedral spaces. So this meridian was not from Michelangelo's time, but 200 years later, and intersects diagonally across. And in Bologna at San Petronio, which is the other one, it just barely misses this sort of vault, massive pillars that are, you know, holding the vaults of the church. It's just they found the one place where it could be embedded into the floor. Yeah. Gorgeous, really gorgeous. And then down below are two of dozens of photographs I took, which I think will be a work. I haven't printed all of them, and I'm still thinking about how to format them and present them, but. Quite near the Academy in Rome, a very curvy street, Viale 30 Aprile, so the Viale of the 3rd of April. Such a curvy road that they have a white line at the edge of the road so that the motorists and the motorinos won't run off the road. And of course, they didn't sweep the road before the line was painted. So there's this track of sort of natural forms that have, that were simply caught in the spray of this white stripe, which was yet another kind of time, light, seasonal marker that I connected to the meridians. And I know, even when I was in Rome that year, 2006 into 2007, I was already thinking about these thresholds. So formally, visually, I see them really tied together. The intent is, and I will do this, is in the end of May, to go back to Rome and record the sound from that road and make a sound piece that attaches itself to these images.
We'll happily consult with equipment. We can tell you all about it.
I will welcome any kind of recording advice.
We can
absolutely
do that.
So I'd be walking, I will be walking, and cars and motorinos will be zooming past me. So
I think the best piece of equipment you could take is like a blaze orange hunting jumpsuit so nobody runs you over. Like Italy, people are crazy.
No, it is nuts. It's really,
really terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, there's you have a painting up on the wall which is very different than the rest of the works that we've talked about, and it is of... you know, speaking of noticing details, I find now that I have a house that I'm constantly trying to repair,
right,
I notice details in buildings like I never did before. I mean, when I first came in this afternoon, I mean, we talked about the details in your house for a while. So you've got it's a painting of a light fixture on one of the ceilings. It's a period light fixture to the house. And then... it's like a band. It's almost like lens flare. But
right.
It's
so it has a subtitle. So its title is Lumen 2. And then its subtitle is Parhelion, which is, we should walk down the wall and I can show you this wonderful painting from Stockholm. So this is an example of it is an oddball painting, but it's connected to this, in my eyes, it's connected to this pipe fence painting from 89. In that, it's an image of something that's sort of fully painted out. It's not a fragment. It's not an excerpt. It's similarly a bit out of context there. That's completely surrounded by snow, and here is completely surrounded by atmosphere. But A rendering of a completely three-dimensional form. You are correct that it's an oddball work relative to the recent work, but that's a case where this I couldn't get this thing out of my head. You know, it's an image that I carried around for a while. In fact, it's on the studio notebook that was completely filled up before I ever painted the painting. So. You know, sometimes things just sit in my head. And so this was, in a sense, the next painting out. This actually followed Stairs and Landings. It was sort of a standalone painting between Stairs and Landings and Thresholds. And when we were in Rome, we went to Stockholm. There's a remarkable painting in Stockholm called the Parhelion, sort of familiarly called the Parhelion painting. And it's a painting known because it's the earliest representation of Stockholm in a painting. But what's so interesting to me is that it's, and the reason that it was painted was to document a celestial event where multiple suns were seen in the sky in 1635. And when I started making this painting based on this light fixture, I mean, it truly wasn't until I started doing the tracings of that shape that I realized the globes were a hexagon, which of course is the basis of all of these tile paintings forever. So I suddenly felt, you know, like the subject of the work for years now had this kind of light as an embedded subject. And an earlier, much earlier state of this painting had, I don't know, 15 of those light fixtures sort of scattered all over that canvas. They're, if you look closely, they're embedded in there still. And so those are just the rescued sort of rescued tracings of sort of Pentimenti, but then I embellished them. And I embellished them in relation to sort of knowing about this this celestial event where multiple suns were seen in the sky at the same time. Sort of sleeping under this light fixture, which is where which is my relationship to this object, which is I sleep under it. And it's sort of occupying a kind of, it's occupying a kind of head space or dream space or ceiling space, projection space, but with six sides and light became spectrum. Spectrum really opened up a way for me to think about these specific kinds of color to attach to the thresholds. So I owe some idea about how to have another kind of investigation, another kind of reason in the six, came out of color. It's, you know, it's a rather flat-footed description, but it happily occupied my thinking. And even this sort of aspect of illumination is going on in these threshold paintings, I think, with some closer looking.
Julian, if you spend a good 2-3 years rolling around a painting in your head, how long does it take you to, say, think about renovations?
All the renovation happens in the paintings. It doesn't happen in the house.
Have you guys done any work to the house in the last 20 years? Like, have you changed anything major?
You know, Richard, I was mentioning this to Richard when you arrived tonight. Richard Rizak has done some things, but not huge major renovations, because the house was really in great shape when we got it. I described the sledgehammering of the decorative fireplace that became a bookshelf. You know, that I would say that was a major factor, and I could describe a few other sort of, you know, things that I got really invested in. The tile around the bathtub in the second floor bathroom. You know, I spent weeks figuring out where those six or seven green tiles were going to fall in the white, the six or seven among the otherwise white. You know, but that was absolute pleasure. But duration, you know, the duration in the work is, I think it's really tied to the duration of living there.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a lot of fun.
Great questions.
I look forward to seeing your shows coming up.
Thank you.
We're going to be in New York in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait to see the Whitney.
With the Apex show.
Yeah.
Fantastic. You will... So it's very likely that you will have a little sound leakage from another video work on that floor.
Those motherfuckers.
It's inevitable. It's on every floor, but I'm pretty fortunate that it's not worse.
Can we just talk? Is it the Ryman's at the Art Institute that's next to Clown Torture?
It was. Well, Clown Torture's down.
Oh, okay.
It's been replaced with a different work of Naumann's. But that was an impossible juxtaposition for me.
I have
me.
To say, that was one of the... There were two things that just offended
me... No, that was a
me,
tough one.
...offended me personally in the modern wing, and that was one of them, and the fact that you can't walk around the Brancusi's.
Right.
Boy, that makes me mad.
Right.
It is Ryman's, right?
Rather. It's the Ryman room. Like, no, oh, yeah, the Charter
like
Series.
Totally it's... understated, quiet.
No,
like...
you just have to hold your ears or Holy put on your crap. Headset, you know, or something.
That's like white that's like noise. A like a Bach Slayer, like double bill.
Yeah, no, yeah. That was a tough one.
I think that's the same stupid example I used the last time I complained about.
And
that.
It's one of the most wonderful rooms installed, I think. The way it gets the light from the Art Institute, you know.
Oh, I
mean, excuse me, from the windows, from the north windows. Yeah.
I, of course, thought you were talking about the Nauman. The Ryman's.
No, the Ryman's.
I'm really just trying to rile up everybody else in the room. So I'll just...
minimalism.
Thank you
so much, Julia.
My pleasure, too. Thanks.
Standing in the doorway of my life in this house, trying to find a way to get out, looking for a sign that I should open the door. This craziness is getting me down, but today is the day we break free.
That was Bad Sports. As always, Bad Sports would like to thank the people that made this show possible.
Bad Sports is Christopher Hudgens, Serena Worthington, Lauren Ballone, Audrey Mast, Meg Only, Claudine Say, Stephanie Burke, Jen Gillespie, Mike Benedetto, Terry Griffith, Joanna Topor McKenzie, Lori Waxman, Nate Lee, Amanda Browder, Lulu Saleh, Tom Sanford, Brian Andrews, Patricia Maloney, Matt Nash, Mark Steph Brandall, and Steve Hammond and Joe Trupian.
312-772-2780 is the phone number for Bad at Sports. If you want to leave a phone commentary that can potentially be run as part of the show, you know where to reach us. You know everything about us. It's Bad at Sports, badatsports.com, badatsports@gmail.com. God bless you. Enjoy the internet. It's all of our new homes.
That doesn't make any sense.
Uh-oh, my phone's ringing.
Maybe I should wait just a minute or two. It's getting cold now. I feel so insecure. The future is a mistress that is so hard to please. And the past is a pebble in my shoe. But today is the day we break free. Today is the day we break free.